And now it's time for Power of Prophecy with your host, former professor at the University of Texas at Austin, career United States Air Force officer, and best-selling author, Tex Mars.
Hello, friends. This is Tex Mars. Welcome to another edition of Power of Prophecy. You know, I've been in a lot of bookstores. I guess that's one of the places that I love, any kind of a bookstore. But I tell you, we're going to talk about a book today and a subject that, well, I must admit, you just won't find it hardly in a regular commercial bookstore. Well, those of you who have been with our ministry for a long time or maybe even a short time, you know that we offer books here that you can't really find almost anywhere else. But I see the value of these books, and I know how important they are. Books, of course, can change the world. They really can. I'm not saying that any of my books have changed the world, but I try. I try my best to change my little corner of the world much as I can. But this is a book that could, if people would read it, if enough would read it, this book we're going to be discussing today with the author who I have with me. And it's a book that is about history. Now, right away you say, oh, history, I never did good in that in school. Wait just a minute. We're talking about real history. In fact, I'm going to ask my guest what real history is, because most of the history books that I read are bogus. Henry Ford, the great industrialist, once said about history, he said, history is bunk. So if it's bunk, meaning nonsense, then how do we find real history? But most of all, do we not need it? Has it not been stated that those who refuse to discover the lessons of history are doomed to repeat them? I think that's true. You know, I served in the U.S. Air Force back during the Vietnam War, and all the lessons that we should have learned from Vietnam, and I earned, I guess you could call it earned, the Vietnam Service Medal and spent 2 years in Southeast Asia during that period. All the lessons we should have learned, it seemed like nobody really learned them well. Maybe it's because the true history of Vietnam has not been written. Well, I have a lady on my program today. She's written some real history. I don't know whether she could be called a revisionist or not. A revisionist is a person, you know, that revises history because they know that history is bunk, most of it. And most historians, to get along with the establishment, will lie and cheat and deceive. And then they join the little exclusive club. But evidently this lady is not interested in joining, you know, the old country club of historians, but in telling the truth. Her name is Deanna Spingola. Now, she's a radio host. That's actually how I met Deanna. She was kind enough to invite me on her radio program on Republic Broadcasting. But then I did just a little research on her because I found out that she did a book. She has authored a book, which we're going to offer you. So you'll want to get your pencil and pen or paper. And halfway during this program, we're going to have, a commercial like we always do. But I'm going to be offering Deanna Spingola. Now, that's spelled S-P-I-N-G-O-L-A. I'm going to be offering her book. Let me give you the title of it. The Ruling Elite. Right away, you know, when I saw that, my little ears perked up. I looked like sort of like, you know, Dr. Spock almost. All right. Anyway, The Ruling Elite. But the subtitle is just as fascinating. A Study in Imperialism, Genocide, and Emancipation. That sounds like sort of a highbrow book. And I guess it could be because Deanna Spingola, she's pretty intellectual, pretty intelligent, to be honest with you. But the thing about it is it was readable even for folks like you and me. And I could understand it perfectly. And boy, did it ever clue me into some areas of history that I had maybe overlooked. And I'm pretty much a historian and researcher myself. But there were things in here that greatly interested me and spiraled me off into even deeper research. But on the other hand, I understand that Deanna has another book coming out pretty quick. And I'll ask her about that later on in the program too. And maybe that'll fill in even more gaps in my knowledge. I love the truth movement. That's what she's a part of, telling the truth. She's a truth teller, and she's willing to go back in history, and then we can, you know, map it back up to today and find out who really controls things, who are the ruling elite, and, well, are they really a bunch of war makers, bloodthirsty devils? Have they committed genocide? And their offer to emancipate us, to bring us more democracy, to bring the whole world into a democratic era of love and peace and harmony, is that going to pan out? Or do they even really mean it? All these are questions we're going to be asking today's guest. Deanna Spingola, welcome to Power of Prophecy.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
You know, you're a very accomplished person. I understand you've got even books on quilting.
I do, on art quilts.
Well, see, art quilts, that is, I'm telling you, I went with Wanda to this art quilt, I don't know if you'd call it a convention or expo or fair, in Houston, Texas. It was gigantic.
Oh, yes.
And let me tell you, we spent the whole day there. You could have spent a week. And the art was really exquisite, beautiful. I was in such a grand place. It bewildered my senses, and I realized, I mean, these folks are really talented, but you've taught classes in quilting, and then how did you branch out from that to really one of the finest books I've seen, 684 pages long, I might mention to folks, on the ruling elite? What spiraled you into this?
Well, I've always loved history. It was my favorite class in school, and I got into the truth movement after 9/11 and began writing articles for several different websites. And the articles were always, you know, very restrictive because you can only write just so long of an article, you know, 2,500 words or so. And then a couple of publishers contacted me within a couple of days of each other and both asked me to write a book.
Hmm.
And I went with the first one. And just kept writing and writing and writing, and pretty soon I had 1,200 pages, and then we decided that we would divide it up into three books. And then just about the time, about 3 or 4 weeks before he was supposed to publish it, he called me up and he said, you know, I kind of want you to change a bunch of things. I want you to take out some words, and then I want you to wait a year. And I thought, I don't think so. So I just went ahead and did it on my own, and the first book, which would have been like 400 pages, grew to be 684, and the second book, which I just turned into the printer on Monday, is going to be just a tiny, tiny bit longer.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm very impressed. I'm impressed not because of the length of the book, but because of what you say in your book, Deanna, and that's why we're offering it through Power of Prophecy and highly recommending it to our folks. Now, you know, it's the media, isn't it, that control the newspapers and, of course, today television and the internet, not all the internet, thankfully, but the major houses or websites, but also publishing, you know, of books and things. A lot of people say, well, in the last 20 years or 30 years, the Zionist control of our media has taken place. But in your book, you show historically this has a long lineage of the takeover and manipulation of what we can see and read and hear, right?
Oh, absolutely. It began as early as 1833.
Hmm.
And it began in Germany. A couple of fellows, Gauss and Weber, installed the first operational electromagnetic telegraph between a town called Polinerkirch, which was the city center of Göttingen University. And this invention was basically the foundation for all electronic media transmission, which now encompasses fax, text messaging, and, as you say, the Internet. And in 1833, that same year, Israel Beer Jehoshaphat, a 17-year-old rabbi son from Kassel, had just moved to the university town to start an apprenticeship at his father's at his uncle's bank. And while he was serving in this banking apprenticeship, he evaluated and figured out a way to exploit Gauss and Weber's invention to improve communications. Now, certain people have a propensity, a skill that they finally tune when they are like kind of leeches, and they exploit and extract the ingeniousness of other people for their own benefit. And so, anyway, Jehoshaphat immigrated in 1845 to Britain, and he called himself by another name. Then he decided to become a Christian, which he did on November 16, 1845, and he changed his name to Paul Julius Reuter.
Ah.
And a week later, he got married, and in 1847, the couple left London and went to Berlin, where he bought a bookstore with another gentleman. And in 1848, he was very, very busy doing a lot of publishing during what was called the Revolution in Germany. And in Europe, in 1848-49, there were a lot of revolutions. So he had to leave Germany, and he went to Paris because of his revolutionary activities. He went to Paris, and he worked for another news agency, Havas. And that was basically became a competitor. And in early 1851, he relocated to London, and they were just at that point in time constructing a cable under the English Channel. And in April 1851, he contacted Rothschild and Son in London and offered to transmit some of his news and some of his other documents and whatnot through this cable. And so he ultimately, on October 10th, 1851, established a telegraph office near the London Stock Exchange. And what he did, he transmitted market quotations between London and Paris using the new telegraph cable under the English Channel that opened in that year, in November of 1851. And by 1858, he became a naturalized British citizen, and he reorganized and became Reuters Telegraph, which was a joint stock company, and he totally owned it. And he became the first European news agency, and he actually reported Lincoln's assassination. He opened other agencies, including one in Alexandria, Egypt. And he began to offer telegraph cables across the North Sea to reach Germany and France, and then started a service to the U.S. And he had a service to the Far East by 1872 and to South America by 1874. Now, his chief competitors were Havas of France and Wolf of Germany. And so in just a short period of time, these three people got together. It was in 1870. They signed an agreement, the three companies, Havas and Wolf, signed an agreement that they were going to divvy up the world. Havas got South America, and the three, and Reuter got Europe, and they each got their own country and monopolized the rest of the world. And so by the late 1800s, the House of Rothschild controlled not only Reuters, but they also had purchased the major news agencies, Havas and Wolf, just in time to propagandize for World War One.
Now, Havas, and you already mentioned that Reuters was Jewish. Then the other two, Havas and Wolf, those seem to be Jewish names as well.
Possibly, because they kind of hang together, and they are very, they don't assimilate.
No, they don't. It's well known. Most Jews, not all, but certainly the majority, the vast majority, are Israel first. And really, they could care less about their home country, except what it can do for them in terms of money making and their Israel fanaticism. I've certainly discovered that myself. So you're saying the media, control of the media, really began way before the last century. I know when I was a young man, there were so many, even, tells you my age maybe, but there's so many newspaper dailies than there are now. Has there been a continuing consolidation of these newspapers, you think, Deanna, over the decades, so that today we have no real freedom of speech?
Right, because what the news services do, you take Associated Press or UPI or any of those Those are some similar to the news services, the news agencies, wherein they gather all the news, and then they have subscribers who pay a certain subscription fee, and so the news in whatever newspaper you happen to be reading is all going to be the same because it all comes from the very same source. And for, you know, those news agencies, Havas, Wolf, and Reuters, they would simply have all of these newspapers under their jurisdiction and just supply them with the news of the day.
You know, even Wikipedia, all of these organizations today seem to be Jewish controlled. Wikipedia, for example, has a page on me, but talk about real history. It really is totally inaccurate. Not totally, but I mean, it does have my name spelled right. But other than that, my Wikipedia page, which is supposed to be an encyclopedic entry, Deanna, they refuse to list, isn't it, Jerry, my last 20-some-odd books and videos. Just refuse to list them. You know, with names like Conspiracy of the Six-Pointed Star, I guess they said, we don't want to let people know that this book is in print. So evidently, Tex Mars quit writing books, along about 1989. I'm serious. The last 20 books and videos I've done, you will not find on Wikipedia. They just refuse to list them. And every time we go in to type them in to update the Wikipedia entry, they're there for about 2 hours, and then they just disappear. They've got an editor assigned to my Wikipedia page specifically, and he makes sure there's nothing positive about me, but all of it is negative. Well, you know, there's things like, you know, I once talked about a kids' toys being, you know, well, pretty well demonic. And they came out and said that I said that kids' toys were all possessed by the devil and that, you know, I mean, they have stuff that's just unbelievable about me there. They claim that I said one doll was going to transform herself into the whore of Babylon. Well, I don't know of any doll that's going to do that, but that's what they actually said on there. And then, of course, you know, I've taught at 3 universities. They refused to list that. Finally, we sent them evidence that I had taught at 3 universities, and they listed one of them.
Well, I think they want to discredit or minimize your accomplishments. They don't want to list your books.
Right.
And they want to make you look foolish.
Yeah, so believe me, this is the way they do people. And people read that and say, God, that Tex Mars, he must be a nut.
Right.
You know, he believes some little doll you buy at a doll store is going to transform herself into the whore of Babylon. You know, who knows what I said in the book that they took that out of context or whatever.
Right.
So, yeah, so you're absolutely right. But let's go back to what you say here. Now, one of the things you talk about is how Jewish elements were very prominent in America very early. And you discuss the town of New Amsterdam, which is really New York. And you said some of the early residents of New Amsterdam were Jewish?
Yes, indeed. As early as 1654. In early 1654, the Portuguese recaptured a particular area from the Dutch and expelled 150 Jewish families of the wealthy merchant class. And they gave them 3 months to sell their homes and prepare for their departure. Then they got on a ship in May of 1654 and set sail for the Jews of Brazil set sail. Actually, they were going to Holland. In 16 different ships. And, you know, they were taking their slaves with them and all their belongings, so they needed a lot of ships. And the wind blew one of the ships carrying 23 Jews off course. And a Spanish pirate captured the ship and its cargo, and then they sank the vessel, and the men on the French ship, the St. Charles, witnessed the event, rescued the 23 prisoners, and took them to the nearest port, which was New Amsterdam or New York. There are more Jews in New York than any other place on earth, including Israel.
And isn't that amazing? More than even Israel. But don't the Christian, many Christian evangelicals, and of course I'm a Christian myself, but Deanna, so many of them say that it's God's will that all the Jews return to the nation of Israel in the Middle East in the last days. Well, obviously, all those Jews in New York are in, I mean, they're defying God, aren't they?
Well, apparently they are, but who wants to go to Israel and have to start over? I mean, these people are well established, you know, for centuries. And
The Jerry Falwells and the Pat Robertsons say it's God's will that they return.
Well, that's part of the Holocaust hoax. Yeah. But apparently, you know, some of them aren't returning. But I think it's a collective return. I think that that if enough people, all the Jews in the world could not fit in Israel. But as long as they have a preponderance of them in Israel, then it's classified as a return.
I see. But of course, again, it seems to me these people, now I do not believe that God wants them to return in disbelief and depravity like they are. But I'm just sort of making fun, you know, of the Christian evangelicals who say, yes, the Jews will all return because they're not returning. They basically shoot their fingers to say a horrible thing at Christian evangelicals and say, we've got it so well made in America. We're so rich here. Like you say, they control New York and look, that's the financial capital of the world. Well, now, here's something that's interesting. I noticed in your book. Boy, this is controversial. You know, Louis Farrakhan, who neither one of us would agree with in his politics necessarily, but you've done a lot of research and you find that the Jews have a big involvement in the early slave trade, just like Farrakhan and his researchers have discovered.
Absolutely. And it was these same people. Now, in 1654, there was a fellow by the name of Jacob Bar Simpson, and he arrived in New Amsterdam in 1654, and he was part of the East India Company of Holland. He was an employee, and basically leaders in New Amsterdam had prohibited the Jews from participating in the economy. Therefore, they determined to exploit the people and the resources of the land occupied by the indigenous population, and because the ordinances did not pertain to trading with the natives. And so they got together with a bunch of beads and liquor and all that kind of thing and started trading with the Indians. And the majority of all the American slave trading activity initially emanated from New England, and they built the first slave ship in America in 1637, before the Jews even arrived, and that was just shortly after Plymouth Rock, and it was the first of many ships used for slave trading. And in 1646, Massachusetts legalized slavery, which would allow anyone to seize any Indian who he judged to be a manslayer, a traitor, or a conspirator. In other words, it was open season on the indigenous population. And they captured so many Indians that they started to sell them in the Caribbean.
Wait, just a minute. You mean they took American Indians,
mm-hmm.
indigenous peoples, you know, they're called, but I mean, my youth, we call them Indians.
Uh-huh.
And they made them slaves?
Yes.
Jewish traders went out and captured or seized American, this is astonishing, American Indians, and then they shipped them off to the islands somewhere in the Atlantic there.
Well, they captured so many that they couldn't sell them all to the settlers, and so they took them into the islands because they had developed what is called the triangle trade. In other words, slaves from, the initial... They started in 1756 they actually started before that, but they started to seize African slaves, Africans, and brought them back and sold them in New England. And Britain became involved in slave trading during the 17th and 18th centuries, and they established the triangular trade. In other words, slaves from Africa, sugar from the islands, and rum from New England. And that was the entire basis for the British mercantilism.
But in addition to African slaves that they brought over on their ships, these Jewish slave traders, they also took American Indians then and shipped them somewhere as slaves.
Exactly.
Wow.
Plus, providing them with liquor, beads, and everything else. And then what they also did, they used them in the fur trade, because the Indians knew exactly where all the animals were. And so Astor, John Jacob Astor, who came, I'm not sure, I can't remember which year he came over here, but his first employer was a Jew. And that, and Astor, created a network of Indians who helped him in the fur trapping.
So, you know, even today, Jews are very prominent in the fur trade. When you go into a big fur, I don't know what, furrier or whatever they call those, Deanna, a store that sells mink coats and all the others, and it's almost always a Jewish name.
Right.
Selling them.
Yeah, and it started back in, you know, in the 1600s, early 1700s.
John Jacob Astor, that's how he got a lot of his fortune then, I assume, from fur trading and all.
He started in fur trading, and then he also bought a lot of land in Manhattan and put up what we would call high-rises, early-day high-rises, but they were tenements in order for the laborers to live in. And, I mean, these buildings were just, they were rat-infested, no bathrooms. You know, you had several families living in one apartment. It was horrible. Just a terrible thing, but that's how he made his money. And when they orchestrated the famine in Ireland, about 1 million Irishmen came over to Manhattan and supplied the cheap labor for a lot of the industry that was going on in Manhattan, because Manhattan was very industrialized. You know, it was an industrialized area, but the North was more industrialized than the South. The South was agrarian. People lived off the land, and they were connected to the land. They were more Christian. They were not secularized. They were not materialistic. They were laid back, just a totally different mentality. They did have slaves in the South, and those slaves were a product of Northern slave trading, because it was the Jewish traders living up North that did the majority of the slave trading. Out of probably 128 ships, probably 120 belonged to Jews. And that's how they made their money. And they transported approximately 2 million Africans to the colonies between 1680 and 1786. Just in 1768, they transported at least 104,000 slaves. And it was part of their culture for, you know, over 200 years. And it was in Newport, Rhode Island, Boston. Those were just the, you know, the really big, the big ports was Newport, Rhode Island, and Boston.
So the Jews, the merchants, were the dominant in the slave trading field. It's interesting that Farrakhan, of course, is just labeled all kind of names, anti-Semite and hater and liar. When he comes out with these facts, nobody ever checks, except Deanna Spingola, perhaps, whether what he's saying is true. It's just a matter of anything that you say that is negative or puts the Jews or Israel in a negative, a bad light, you're going to be attacked and just persecuted horribly. Wow, very, very interesting. Well, Deanna, when we come back, I have some questions, because one of the major areas of your book is the Civil War.
Oh, yes.
And I've always had questions about the Civil War. Seemed like some of the historical things didn't fit right. And there's all these great historians that have written about all the battles and the politics of it. And some things just didn't ring true. But then I got your book, and I think you sort of put things back in order and corrected a lot of the history. And I know it took a lot of work, a lot of effort. When we come back, we're going to talk about Honest Abe Lincoln, as he was called, what really happened when the North invaded the South, a lot of things, even maybe did a false flag event occur that started the Civil War?
Sure was.
All right. Well, we're going to talk about it when we come back the second half. You're listening to Power of Prophecy. I'm Tex Mars. My guest today, historian, talk show host, and, well, she's artist in a lot of things, very accomplished, Deanna Spingola. Stay with us. We'll be right back. is Tex Mars again. You know, I have a copy here of Deanna Spingola's book, The Ruling Elite, subtitled A Study in Imperialism, Genocide, and Emancipation. I want you to have this, friends. I think you're going to really enjoy it. I mean, it covers the waterfront of history, especially American history, and really, it's just, I think it's exciting myself to study these things and find out what really happened. And Miss Spingola has certainly found out what happened. Now, the book is a huge book. It's a paperback of 684 pages. But I like that. That's not one you can put in your back pocket, take to the beach, is it? So it takes a little effort. It's a little bit heavy. But I write books of that size, too, so I appreciate them. And I appreciate what a real accomplishment this is. You know, you can go to the library. There's hundreds of books on American history and even the Civil War. They're all the same. They all have the same script. They have the same blueprint. There's things that they can say and that they can't say. And as Deanna Spingola told you herself, publishers were interested in publishing her works, but then they wanted her to change things. I've had that occur to me, too. You know, they don't want to make this group or that group angry, and they want to make your book more commercial. If you could just take this section out, we could sell more copies of your book. Well, Deanna Spingola said no. She wanted to tell the truth. And that's why I value her work and highly recommend it. Now, for this huge book, The Ruling Elite, just ask for The Ruling Elite. Or say, hey, give me Deanna's book. Or Spingola. By the way, her talk show is called Spingola Speaks. Sort of interesting. $35 and $5 for shipping and handling. A total of $40. That's postpay. We'll take care of all the shipping and everything. Now, we've been assured we can get enough copies in, and we're going to keep it in print here for a long time for you. So you'll want to order a copy right now, again, for a total of $40, and it's about the size of three regular books, $40 total. That includes all the shipping and handling. Ask for the book by Deanna Spingola, or just Deanna's book, The Ruling Elite, and we'll get it right off to you, okay? Now, I want to mention, too, that Deanna has I'm going to ask her when she comes on. She has a talk show, as I said, on Republic Broadcasting Network. We'll ask her about that. I'm going to ask her, too, about the next book she has coming out. It's not published yet, but we'll probably be offering that through the ministry here as well. The Ruling Elite, A Study in Imperialism, Genocide, and Emancipation. I think I'm going to ask her why she has that subtitle. That's very interesting. Here's how to get your copy of this book. And I think once you get it, you're going to want to order another copy for a friend. I'll tell you what happened to me. Deanna was kind enough to send me a copy of her book. I was reading it at home, and I had it actually was on the kitchen counter, you know, sort of the bar area, I guess you call it, between the kitchen and the family room where you put stuff. And I had some friends come over, in fact, my personal physician and his wife. And right away, she grabbed hold of that book. She liked the cover, I guess. It has a picture of the world, the globe, with chains on it. And she said, this is an interesting book. And I knew right away, you know, she's that kind of person. She had to have it. And since she's such a precious friend, I said, well, you can go ahead and have this copy, and I'll get another copy. And so I was forced to order it. I think that's what happens to a good book. Your friends come over, and they demand you give them your book. And you have to order a second one. But then that's the pleasure of having friends. And then you know that they are reading the same thing you are, and they're getting the same enjoyment and blessing from the book. So I know that my good friend Sharon and her husband David, they enjoyed themselves. And that gave me pleasure knowing they were enjoying reading this great book. Okay, so you'll probably want to order another when you've got it. But right now, at least order your first copy. Here's how to get it. The Ruling Elite. Phone is toll-free 1-800-234-9673. That's toll-free 1-800-234-9673. You can get our book online at powerofprophecy.com. It's on our homepage. You'll see a picture of Deanna's book. And just click on there, and it'll take you to the website where you can use your PayPal or one of your charge cards and order the book from us. And, of course, we get our books right out. That's what we do. We don't wait around 2, 3, 6 weeks for an order, do we, Jerry? That's nonsense. When I order a book, I want it now. And I know that people do, and that's why we work hard here. Sometimes we work evenings you know, holidays and everything else we have in the past. I'm just a slave master, right, Jerry? I'm not even Jewish and I'm a slave master. It's terrible how bad I am. Just, you know, tote that barge, lift that bell to the employees. They complain all the time, but that's just the way it is. Okay, we're in Texas. We're in a right-to-work state. I guess that's what they call it. You have a right to be a slave, too, here in Texas. Well, okay, that's how to get the book. Call us toll-free. Now, that's during the week, Monday through Friday, Central Time, 8 to 5:30. Or go 24/7 to our website and order the book. And there'll be a description of the book and a picture of the book right on the home page. Let's see, Jerry, how else can people get the book? They can write us, naturally. Okay, Power of Prophecy, 1708 Patterson Road, Austin, Texas, 78733. That's Patterson Road, P-A-T-T-E-R-S-O-N Road, Austin, Texas, 78733. And, of course, that's the Republic of Texas. But don't put that on your envelope. They don't want you to get you arrested or anything like that. That's our little secret here, that we're the Republic of Texas. Just our building. Just, you know, 1708 Patterson Road. We have a very small territory here for the Republic of Texas. So just put USA if you're overseas, or just leave that blank and just put Texas, 78733. Okay, now let's return to our program. Ms. Deanna Spingola is our guest. She's the author of The Ruling Elite. Deanna, a couple questions. You're on Republic Broadcasting with your program, Deanna Speaks. Tell us how people can listen to your program.
Okay, they can just go to republicbroadcasting.org, and I'm on Monday through Friday from 11 to 1 at Central Standard Time, and I have a lot of very nice guests. You've been on the program a couple of times, and I try to have some very interesting people. We talk about a lot of really good things.
Now, let's face it, Deanna, you are a troublemaker, aren't you?
I really am.
Okay.
We might as well just tell the truth here. Yes.
There you go. We're truth tellers here. But you're the kind of truth teller that, you know, troublemaker that we like. You know, you go back to the Bible, they were all those Old Testament prophets and the New Testament. They were just a bunch of troublemakers. But bless their souls. I'm glad for that. Now, you have another book that you say you've sent the manuscript already?
Yes, I sent it off on Monday to
the
printer.
Is it okay to ask you the title?
It is called The Ruling Elite, The Zionist Seizure of World Power.
Oh, my goodness. Do you know when that might be out?
Probably in 3 weeks.
Oh, really? You mean it'll be actually off the press in 3 weeks?
I believe so, because I sent it to the printer, and, you know, it's all been edited, and so it basically just has to be printed up.
How wonderful. Would you be so kind as to send Power Prophecy a copy of that so we can review it and perhaps offer it on our program?
I would be very happy to.
Thank you so much. That sounds like a great follow-up to this book. Now, listen, we only have about 25 minutes or 20 minutes, and I've got so many questions to ask you. The North and the South, I mean, everybody knows about it, but they see Gone with the Wind and they think they know it. Or like I was in school, you know, basically they told us that the South was mean, evil, cruel. Everybody down South owned slaves, and all of them wanted to keep beating their slaves and tormenting their slaves until honest Abe Lincoln came along and freed the slaves because he loved them so much, and they put down the mean old horrible people from the South and gave the slaves their freedom. That's pretty well what I learned in the textbooks. But evidently you've learned a lot of other things. Tell us a little bit about some of your findings.
Well, actually, it really had nothing whatsoever to do with the slaves. The Civil War was a war that was actually fought to impose socialism on this country.
Mm.
In fact, I call it, you know, with regard to Lincoln, if an individual acts like a socialist, speaks like a socialist, enacts legislation like a socialist, abolishes freedom like a socialist, and provokes a revolution like a socialist, then that person is probably a socialist. Now, they had what is called propaganda. You know, we think of propaganda as something very recent, but the propaganda that was most popular just before the Civil War was something called Uncle Tom's Cabin, and it was written by Harriet Beecher Stowe. Now, Harriet Beecher Stowe was married to a Mr. Calvin Stowe, who was a part of the Illuminati. And she had never actually visited the South, but she created this picture, this book. It actually started out serialized in one of those newspapers, you know, the ones that are controlled by a certain ethnic group.
Mm.
It started out as a serialized story, and basically what it was created for, it was devised to create outrage among the northern folks. Now, they would never have gone to war just to free the slaves, because after all, there were slaves in the North. And the thing about the North is that they really didn't like blacks. They just felt they were good enough to do all the work, to build up all the infrastructure, to build those ships so that they could go over and get more blacks over in Africa. They could do all that hard work. But the thing about a slave is that when they could no longer work, then the owner was obligated to take care of that person until they died. But with cheap labor, such as the Irish, who came over here in about 1854, about a million of them came over here in about 1854, you could pay them a dollar a day. If they got caught in one of your machines and their legs got chopped off or something, well, heck, you just throw them out in the street and you didn't have to worry about them anymore. It was a different kind of slavery. It was a wage slavery. And, you know, all those factories that they had up north. See, the South is very agrarian, but the North was, they had industry. They had textile mills. And those textile mills hired people as young as four to work in those, to work, 16, 18 hours a day. And then if they quit working, well, they were just out of a job.
So they were basically, they were children slaves, and they were white.
Yes, they were.
Wow.
Yes, they were. And a lot of them were female. And the boss was usually a man. There was a lot of exploitation of all kinds. And it was a terrible situation. And but the thing with emancipation, the big thing about emancipation is that as long as there was ownership of one group of people, then there was restrictions. But so emancipation literally leveled everybody to the same status. It leveled everybody.
So like socialism, you're saying, they really gave us socialism. They leveled everybody, just like in the Soviet Union. They told everybody, your chains are being loosed, now you're free. But really, they became slaves in the communist empire.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Wow. Mm.
And emancipation, you know, is something that the Illuminati has always used because it works. You know, you talk about, oh, women's freedom. Well, then pretty soon the women are free to kill their children. Mm. You know? I mean, it's freedom. Freedom is God-given. It isn't given by a government. And so this war, it became about emancipation of the slaves about a year after it started. And the reason that it took so long to actually talk about emancipation is because the socialists in this country, as well as Marx and Engels, persuaded Lincoln to use that ruse to get to free the slaves. Now, it didn't free the slaves in the North. It only freed the slaves in the South.
The proclamation.
Yes, the proclamation.
By Lincoln.
Emancipation Proclamation did not free any of the slaves up North. And there were more military men in the service of the Union who owned slaves than there were military men in the South who owned slaves.
Now, I think your book points out that Robert E. Lee, the head general for the South, actually freed all of his slaves before he took command of the armies of the South.
He did. Whereas Grant didn't free his slaves until he was forced to after the war.
Interesting.
And speaking of the war, we often hear about false flags. And It is no different with the Civil War, what I call Lincoln's War. Because the Civil War is when two factions of a country fight for control of the government. But these were two different governments. You know, the state succeeded, and they set up their own government. It was a totally different government. And the false flag was at Fort Sumter. Now, when Charleston is very significant. It's located at the 33rd degree northern latitude, and Freemasons, as early as 1801, organized the first highest Masonic council there under the leadership of Hyman Isaac Long, a Jew.
Mm.
In fact, he was living in Jamaica, in Kingston, Jamaica, and then he moved to south.
That's interesting, isn't it? You know, if you go back and you study the Masons, you find out that even in the days of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and the others, that Masonic Jews came over and founded the Scottish Rite. Before that, Washington and the others had been members of the United Lodge of Great Britain.
Right.
But they left membership in that and joined the Illuminati-style lodge, or sect, I call it, a Freemasonry called the Scottish Rite. And they were the more revolutionary Illuminist variety of Masons.
Right.
So the Jews have always been involved in Freemasonry and revolutions. Does that go all the way back to the Order of the Illuminati? Because even there we have Ida Weishaupt, who was a Jew.
Right, right. And it was a situation where there was already an organization, and the Illuminati has always infiltrated existing organizations and then taken them over. They've done the same thing with churches. They've done the same thing with you know, whatever organization they felt was viable that they could just infiltrate.
You know, one of the things I'd like to ask you is this. It seems to me, I've read about some of the young Southern men who died, lost limbs, suffered so much in the Civil War, so-called, as you mentioned, is really a war between two independent nations, the Confederacy and the Union. But did all of these young soldiers, did they go off to war so that they could retain their slaves?
No, there were there were very few slave owners and in the South. A lot of the slave owners owned the big plantations, and in fact, those big plantations were obtained when Andrew Jackson, implemented Thomas Jefferson's Indian policies, which meant that they were going to move all of the Indians out of the South, take over their land, and create plantations. Now, it was Thomas Jefferson who actually created the policy, but it was Jackson who implemented it. And we've often heard of the Trail of Tears, where all of these poor people, poor Indians, who had lived on their land for just decades and decades, generations, and they were basically just told to move, and so many of them perished. I mean, terrible. Reading about this, I mean, it makes you cry.
They evidently had very fertile land with abundant life, wildlife that they could eat.
Well, and they also had some gold.
And as you point out, is that right? And then they were moved, these Indian tribes, by Jackson and his cohorts to the most God-forsaken, desolate areas of the United States.
Right.
Dusty, dry, no water, no forest, no shelter. It must have been a horrible experience for them.
Right. But when they discovered gold in Georgia, then, oh my goodness, you know, they had to get these Indians out of there and take over the land. And a lot of Jackson's buddies went down and started these big plantations. Now, there were some slave owners who did not have plantations. Maybe they had 100 acres or something, or smaller, and they would work right along with their slaves. And after emancipation, a lot of those slaves still maintained contact with the people who owned them. That's such a hard thing to say, but they still maintained contact with them. I mean, you had black mammies who nursed white babies. They had a different feeling towards these people. You know, it was just they cared more about them. They weren't interested in just extracting labor. As I said, many of them worked right alongside their slaves in the fields, and it is not like what was portrayed, certainly, in Gone with the Wind.
Well, you know, the state of Texas, of course, voted to be a part of the Confederacy. There were very few slaves in the state of Texas, and most of the landowners did not have slaves at all. It shows you again that the reason for fighting the war was not slavery, but evidently was for freedom, liberty, and independence.
No, it was actually to destroy the state's rights. It was to impose Marxism.
The war.
And when you think about who promoted the war, who fought the war, and if you think about the 48ers, now, I mentioned before that there were revolutions in Europe in 1848-1849. Those revolutions were not all that successful. And so many of the people that fought in those revolutions came over here, at least 500,000 Germans who fought in the German area came over here to fight in the Union Army because they were unsuccessful in Germany until 1871, and so they came over here. They fought with the Union. There were many regiments that were completely German. German.
Why did they do that, Deanna?
Why did they do that?
Yeah, the Germans, uh-huh.
Well, they were Marxist.
And
Karl Marx was German. And a lot of these people had association with Marx. They came over here to do in America what they could not do in Germany because the Germans wouldn't allow it. They chased them out of the country. They incarcerated a lot of them. And many of them fled to Paris, and then they came over here. A lot of them went to England and then came over here. And in fact, a lot of them basically elected Lincoln. They got on Lincoln's side, and they elected him as president. They worked very hard for the Lincoln campaign because he believed in the American system, which was basically a socialist system. It was the system of Hamilton's Federalist Party, which evolved into the Whig Party, and Lincoln was a Whig, and then the Whigs became Republicans in 1854. And so Lincoln basically was a socialist. He supported the American system, or, you know, Hamilton's system, and he was very pro-war, and went in. He gave a talk in about 1858 talking about the division, you know, the Great Divide, and he was promoting war as early as 1858, and then of course you had Harriet Beecher Stowe and her propaganda novel, and so the Civil War was definitely not about saving. They said it was about saving the Union. Well, why would you have to kill almost 700,000 people to save the country? I mean, that's as ridiculous as saying, okay, we're going to Afghanistan, we're going to Iraq, we're going to impose democracy. But we might have to kill a million people, but we're going to do that.
Well, I mean, not only that, but golly, you're right about that. And of course, look at the great destruction of a civilian, you know, unarmed combatant, non-combatants. All those homes destroyed, and I mean, it really has taken almost all the way up to today, just our generation, to rebuild the South. And what it was, I mean, entire cities were burnt down, and I mean, old men, women, children alike were murdered by cannon fire from the Northern guns.
Right. Now, this was the very first war. It was a modern war. It was the first total war. And by total war, I mean that everybody was vulnerable. They targeted men, women, children, all the animals, all the food production, everything that moved. This was a total war. In other words, before that, wars were fought on a battlefield. Mm. You know, the two sides would line up against each other, and they would fight it, military men.
And civilians were sort of untouched then.
No non-combatants were involved.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Civil War, in Lincoln's war, it was Marxist revolutionaries and socialists who embraced his revolutionary philosophy, and they fought for Lincoln, doing what they couldn't do in Germany and in other European countries.
Well, so when John Wilkes Booth jumped on the stage after shooting Lincoln in the head in Ford's Theater and cried out, "The tyrant is dead," maybe that was, I'm not saying that he did the right thing or was a good man, but maybe in assassinating Lincoln, he was at least correct in framing or describing Lincoln as a tyrant.
Well, he was certainly a tyrant. You know, it sounds like a really good thing that he said, "Oh, I'm going to free the slaves." It was not a humanitarian gesture because they had black laws, black codes in the North. They didn't want the slaves up there. They wanted to deport them all. They wanted to either ship them back to Africa or ship them to Haiti. They really, it wasn't a humanitarian thing at all.
So Lincoln did not want the slaves to live, to stay and live in America, but he intended to deport them or
exactly
ship them off back to Africa then.
Yes. And what he wanted to do, and he said it in a speech, and it was in New York, in Union Square, in April of 1861, and he argued that liberty was indivisible. And this was a view shared by Marx, and that this disunion would be a curse to the United States, just as it had been to Germany. Marx and Engels were adamantly pro-union and anti-Southern, and their followers echoed their sentiments. In other words, they wanted an indivisible country. You cannot communize a country that has sovereignty, that wherein each state has sovereignty. You have to have a unified country in order to impose communism, and that was Marx's objective.
You know, I can imagine, and also the South obviously believed in property rights.
Exactly.
That's very, the strongest thing was the property rights of the individual.
Including property of their slaves.
Mm.
You know, because even before Lincoln ran, he says, you know, I don't have anything against people owning slaves. That was not his contention.
He just did not want so all those people, 700,000, perished because he wanted to keep them all in one country, which is absolutely insane.
Well, he wanted to centralize the government power.
Exactly. Well, Deanna, we're out of time here, and there's so much more I'd like to talk about. I hope you'll be kind enough to come on in the future, especially
when your
new book is out, because it's a very important book, The Ruling Elite. And thank you for coming on today to share your information, your knowledge with us.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
That's Deanna Spingola, folks. She's from the state of Illinois, I believe.
Yes.
And her book, you are okay, The Ruling Elite. It's a book you've got to have. Of course, go to powerofprophecy.com or call us toll-free 1-800-234-9673. Or write to us, Power Prophecy, 1708 Patterson Road, Austin, Texas, 78733, to order the book. And as always, we'll give you a free subscription to our newsletter for at least 6 months when you order anything at all, and especially if you order Deanna Spingola's book. Until next time, friends, this is Tex Mars inviting you to tune in each week and discover the power of prophecy.